Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Edwige Dantica, whose book, Brother, I'm Dying, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, and welcome to the fourth inaugural season, the inauguration of the fourth season of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. We are here again live at the Looking Glass Theater. I want to thank you all for making this show, this series, such a success. Looking Glass Theater, Chicago Magazine, WFMT Radio, thank you all, and particular thanks to the Maven Chronicles for underwriting our fourth season. Let's give them a hand. Thank you. We have a fantastic lineup for the fourth season. Andrea Barrett is coming, Ann Packer, Russell Banks, Richard Price, and I'll be giving you some details about that later on. But first, the reason why you are all here today, she was born in Haiti. She moved to the United States at age 12. She wrote her first novel in her third adopted language, that was English, and published it to incredible fanfare at age 25. Edwige Dantica has had such an impressive, really a stellar literary career in her relatively short 38-year-old life. After Breath, Eyes, Memory in 1994, her second novel, Crick, Crack, was nominated for the National Book Award, along with the likes of Philip Roth. Other books and stories and essays and many prizes and nominations followed. The Farming of Bones, The Dewbreaker, two books for young readers, the American Book Award, the first story prize. The list is way too long. I just can't even go on with it. Through them all, Dantica's readers have been transported by her powerful, lyrical, very personal stories of Haiti, whether on the island itself or through the many communities of Haitian immigrants, past and present. Dantica has been their witness, their voice, and finally their champion. Now she has done the very same thing for her own family in the searing memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. Dantica, Edwige Dantica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for me.
Fantastic to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, well, we had to turn a lot of people away. Look, I'm compelled to point out that another measure I have found of an author's success, at least in this country, is when they have a really brisk business on the internet selling term papers about their work. Not that you're selling them, but I notice there's a lot of students here today and students listening. Your work is taught in many high schools and many colleges and universities. And for $25 up to $79, you can get some really good essays, you know, purportedly written by these kids about your work. And I hope I'm not blowing it for anybody today.
Well, I should get into that business.
Yeah, you could, I'm sure.
The hardback is only $23.95. and I don't get the whole thing in that.
So. Well, you know, see me afterwards. Well, I'd like a cut. this book, Brother, I'm Dying, you say in the first chapter that you are recreating a few wondrous and terrible months. This takes place in 2004, that forced you to look forward and backwards at the same time. And we begin very quickly in the book with the your own discovery of two important things, your own pregnancy, your father's imminent death by he had pulmonary fibrosis, end stage, and then further on in the book, the terrible days of your beloved uncle and surrogate father's escape from Haiti, and ultimate death in the hands of the U.S. Immigration Service. What's curious to me is that you wrote some stories for the New York Times about this not long after it happened, At what point did you decide, I am going to make this a memoir and a family member? When did that thought occur to you?
Well, that thought first occurred to me when after my uncle died, and when he was with his son, my cousin Maxo, and when Maxo was released from custody to go bear him in Haiti, and we couldn't go back after he called, and family that we had there said that it was too dangerous to have the funeral there. But when Maxo came out, he came out with a piece of paper, which was in a transcript of the interview that my uncle had had at the airport with the customs officer. And it was, to me, extraordinarily dramatic. It was something that you couldn't make up, you know, this dialogue with the customs officer, you know, asking my uncle, well, why are you here? And his saying, well, some people try to burn down my church, just saying the same thing over and over, this dialogue that I reproduced, the transcript in the book. So that was the first time it occurred to me that we should first get all those documents, you know, to know, because we want to know what my uncle's last days were like. But that was the first time it occurred to me that I should write about it in this way. As soon as it happened, I thought, you know, I have to let people know. And one of the reasons was that, and one of the documents, too, it said, as they were evaluating whether my uncle should be in or not, it said, is there media or congressional interest in this person? So to me, that said, you know, raise hell, raise hell. And so those two things.
The book has a first chapter, which is called Have You Enjoyed Your Life? Mm-hmm. And each of the chapters in the book have these very telling titles, and that really have the core of whatever that chapter is about. And that chapter is really almost a preamble to what then sets off going back 60 years to Haiti, where we meet your Uncle Joseph and his wife Denise. But you and your family have called, your father has called a family meeting, and we're in Brooklyn in 2004 at that point. Your father is dying. You know it better than he knows it. You know you're pregnant, he doesn't. The family is around. We meet your three brothers, but at that point we don't know that only one of them grew up with you in Haiti. The other two were born in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the question comes up to your father, have you enjoyed your life? And your father's response to that, which was basically, well, you have made me proud, and you didn't do anything bad. You have not shamed me. Seems to have been something of a revelation for you and set you off in this quest to really understand how much he gave up and why. Is that the right interpretation of it?
Actually, that's what happened is that the book opens up with a visit to a pulmonologist in Brooklyn, where my father gets his definitive diagnosis. And then we go home, and he doesn't, the doctor just tells me, and I was never sure why he didn't tell my father. I thought he was warming up by telling me that the diagnosis was bad and it didn't look good, but then he didn't tell him, he just told me, and then he said, you know, you should tell your family members now. And so I went home with that, and then we debated with my brothers whether we should go and discuss this with him in the way that the doctor had told me, without taking away hope that he might have. And so my father then sort of trumps us on this, and then he holds this meeting where he said, well, I'm not getting better, and I may be dying. So, and he was very sort of, my father's meetings, my brothers and I used to call them these summits, you know, they were very formal and rare, but formal. And he said, well, what are we going to do with your mother? Basically was what the meeting was about. And so we were all stunned that he, you know, he knew this. And so my brother, Bob, who was in Haiti with me, who had spent also like me, a big chunk of the childhood away from my father, said to him in the middle of the meeting, have you enjoyed your life? And after that, you know, like we're all sort of staring at him, sort of, like, how could you go there in a way? But I think my father appreciated, because it really, that opened up a kind of path to the conversations that we had towards his death. And the answer to that was very much, well, he said basically, like, the only thing worth enjoying, it seemed to us that he was saying about his life, was that he had had us. And that was it was just painful in terms of a revelation, in terms of, then it sets you up to thinking of what did he want for his life, and if we were, you know, taking us out of it. I think that's, it's an incredible thing to have had a chance to have heard said by your parent, and we just didn't know what to do with it. You know.
Well, I'd like you to read what happens right after he says that, and I think it will show people like me, like anybody who's an admirer of your work, that the issues in your stories of abandonment, of displacement, of difficult relationships with parents, particularly with women and their mothers, the importance of words and speech and communication in your work, you have shown us the well that you draw on in this book, and you've said that yourself. You're drawing back the curtain. And what you're about to read, I think, really demonstrates that.
Yeah, and this actually, before, when we were separated, my brother and I, from my parents, we used to write these letters, and my father's letters were very short and very clip. And so this is when I was listening to him talk about, at this meeting, I started thinking back to these letters. Listening to my father, I remembered a time when I used to dream of smuggling him words. I was 8 years old, and my brother Bob and I were living in Haiti with his oldest brother, my uncle Joseph, and his wife. And since they didn't have a telephone, few Haitian families did then, and access to the call centers was costly, we had no choice but to write letters. Every other month, my father would mail a half-page, three-paragraph missive addressed to my uncle, scribbled in his minuscule scrawl, sometimes on plain white paper, other times on lined hole-punched notebook pages, still showing bits of fringe from the spiral binding. My father's letters were composed in stilted French, with the first paragraph offering news of his and my mother's health, the second detailing how to spend the money they had wired for food, lodging, and school expenses for Bob and myself, the third section concluding abruptly after reassuring us that we'd be hearing from him again before long. Later, I would discover in a first-year college composition class that my father's letters had been written in a diamond sequence, the Aristotelian poetics of correspondence, requiring an open greeting, a middle detail or weak rest, and a brief farewell at the end. The letter-writing process had been such an agonizing chore for my father, one that he'd hurried through while assembling our survival money, that this specific formula, which he followed unconsciously, had offered him a comforting way of disciplining his emotions. I was no writer, he later told me. What I wanted to tell you and your brother was too big for any piece of paper in a small envelope. Whatever restraint my father showed in his letters was easily compensated by Uncle Joseph's reactions to them. First, there was the public reading in my uncle's furnished pink living room in front of Tante Denise, Bob, and me. This was done so there would be no misunderstanding as to how the money my parents sent for me and my brother would be spent. Usually my uncle would read the letters out loud, pausing now and then to ask help with my father's penmanship, a kindness, I thought, a way to include me a step further. It soon became obvious, however, that my father's handwriting was as clear to me as my own, so I eventually acquired the job of deciphering his letters. Along with this task came a few minutes of preparation for the reading, and thus a few intimate moments with my father's letters. Not only the words and phrases, which did not vary greatly from month to month, but the vowels and syllables, their tilts and slants, which did. Because he wrote so little, I would try to guess his thoughts and moods from the dotting of his I's and the crossing of his T's, from whether there were actual periods at the ends of his sentences or just dots where the tips of his pen had simply lended. Did commas split his streamlined phrases, or they were staccato like someone speaking too rapidly, out of breath? For the family readings, I recited my father's letters in a monotone, honoring what I interpreted as a secret between us, that the impersonal style of his letters was due to as much his lack of faith in words and their ability to accurately reproduce his emotions as to his caution with Bob's and my feelings, avoiding too happy news that might add to the anguish of separation, too sad news that might worry us, and any hint of judgment or disapproval for my aunt and uncle, which they could have interpreted as suggestions that they were mistreating us. The dispassionate letters were his way of avoiding a minefield, one he could have set off from a distance without being able to comfort the victims.
Edwige Dantica, reading from Brother, I'm Dying. Thank you. There is so much packed into that, you know, page and a half. And the some of the most poignant moments of this book are about you as a child trying to get your mind and emotions around the fact that your parents were not there. Your brother Bob was 2 when your father and mother left. You were 4. Your father had left before that. But at 4, both of your parents were living in the United States and making a life that they hoped would be better, and 8 years later finally did bring you into it. And listening to, reading how you were trying to interpret so much emotion of your father's through those words, and that you were doing that even later in your life. It's very clear that this kind of separation that occurred, this emotional separation, really couldn't be bridged very easily. But you were the bridge in this. You were always very aware of writing. You wanted a typewriter from an early age. This kind of communication through letters to your father seems to have really fallen pretty much on your shoulders.
Well, I want to emphasize that this, the type of migration pattern that was part of my family's wasn't unique to us. Even in my uncle's house, you know, there was my cousin and other, you know, and others whose families were elsewhere. But it was always seen as a temporary measure that the parents, you know, precede the children. And my father was really one of the first people in our family to come to the United States. He didn't know what he was coming to. So we didn't see it as abandonment. It wasn't as though we were left, you know, it was just a part of a process. But that being said, I think these separations too, and having a family and that framework, you know, requires a lot of effort at communication. And those letters from my father was part of that. And they tried, you know, my uncle tried to include us in that, and we were always told, you know, that your parents, they will send for you, one day you'll be with them. And we knew, we had a sense that that was beyond our control. But it was all our jobs to try to bridge that, you know, to, but the thing that was wonderful about it is that we still felt like we were part of a family, and that, you know, being with my uncle was like being with my father. And so just the definition of family was just broader, you know. It's just that we had all these people who cared for us, so we weren't, we didn't feel left behind.
And you always felt loved. It was very clear.
Yeah, I mean, we did, I think, because also, you know, my uncle, I think, and my father, whose relationship is explored in this book too, I think we were like stand-ins for the people who were gone, you know. I mean, I think for my, you know, for my aunts on my mother's side, I was like, when they saw me, they saw my mother. Even though my father was gone, my brothers, you know, we were like that for my uncle. So I think there was that at play also, the fact that we, even though the family wasn't all together, that we were loved in our own right, but we represented the love that my father and my uncle had for each other. When they saw us, you know, they saw whatever their past together was. I think that was also playing out in that relationship with us.
You went back in the book and talked about the moment that you and your brother end up coming to the United States, and you actually have tracked down people that were the stewardesses, people that thought that they saw you on the flight, people that were passengers. It was very important for you to nail some of these details.
Yeah, actually, these people tracked me down because I would, after Breath Eyes Memory came out, and which has a kind of reproduction of that flight, but with a different setting. I would meet people who said, "I sat next to you on that airplane," and I met flight attendants who I know these middle-aged Haitian flight attendants. They probably have done hundreds of children like this. You know, the unaccompanied minor, the children with the mustard envelope getting on the plane with their who will then they'll have to accompany through the customs. I mean, they've done hundreds of children like that. But I've met so many who were convinced, that they did my brother and me. And so I've just met so many that I don't even know what happened on that trip. Because I'm like, some of them will say, "Well, yeah, you cried and you guys were kicking." But they get a little bit of that too, I think, because most of them will approach me after reading the book. And so it often happens on the American Airlines flight to Haiti. And the ladies who've been doing it forever, they said, "I know, I did. You haven't changed a bit since."
Still kicking. Well, there is one point where your mother and father return to Haiti. You've been living with your Uncle Joseph. I think you were about 8 years old at that point when they came back. And so you hadn't seen them for 4 years. And they have your young brothers in tow who were born American citizens, Kelly and Carl. And at that point, I can't imagine how a child would absorb it and explain it to yourself, but you did say that it was the only time you've ever felt really intensely jealous of something in your life, when seeing your mother with the young one. I think that was Carl, who was the youngest, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, my brothers, they'll say it now too. They say, they were the anchor babies. They were, the fact that they were born in the United States allowed my parents to be able to apply for their residency here after overstaying their visas. And so the process back then was for one to then get your papers, they had to return to Haiti. And so they returned with my brother Carl, was about 2 months old, and my brother Kelly was 2 years old. And I was seven, and I couldn't at that point, that was the one thing I confessed it to my brothers before I put it in the book, I couldn't explain to myself. Well, I said, "Well, if they can take these small children here, why couldn't they take us there?" And so that was a very, I mean, of course later I understood, but I couldn't at that moment reconcile it. But my mother tried. What she did, I think, in that moment, she always, she always reminds me that I said to her, "Bon Fonti can't be," especially with the baby, like, "let me hold him a little," that I was just immediately enthralled with this baby. And maybe it had something to that with, like, wanting to connect and also wanting to imagine myself at that age in my mother's arms, which at that point I couldn't remember anymore.
Well, and you did say to me on the phone that you still think of your age in two ways, your age as you are and your age as you are without parents, so that you're 38 now, but you're 30 without your parents.
Yeah, maybe that's like a way to stay young. But I started thinking, I mean, there was something when I came here and it was, and sort of children, you sort of have these magical ways of thinking. It's like the magical thinking. So I started thinking, I said, well, I was trying to catch up sort of with my brothers and all the times that they'd had with my parents. And so I said, well, technically I am really whatever age I am, minus the time that we spent apart. So, because my brother Kelly, actually, who was born here, I was about 5 years older than him, and he would always say, "I'm older than you, I'm older than you." And so we always, it's sort of like a weird age thing, but I had continued to sort of think of my age as the age, my chronological age, but also, and subtract from it the time that I spent away from my parents.
Well, and this book examines it all really from your perspective, although, frankly, it is a family member. You are a family memoir. You are much more in the shadows of this, really. It's very much about your uncle, Joseph, and your father, their relationship, and you as the person, sort of the go-between. But I was thinking about, as difficult as it was for you and Bob to absorb these two younger brothers who had this whole other life in America that was without you, how odd it must have been for them to suddenly get these two, you know, much older brother and sister just showing up out of the blue, where they've had your parents' undivided attention. It must have, you seem to have gotten over it pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it was strange for them because when we talk about it now, it's not, my parents never sat them down and said, you know, your brothers and sister are coming. It was just like one day we were there. And so, and they didn't remember, even Kelly didn't remember the trip to Haiti. Like, they didn't remember meeting us, of course. So it was really just one night we showed up. So so I think for, it was harder. Carl, who was about 5 at the time, and Kelly was 7. It was much easier for Carl, I think, because he immediately took to me especially. I think it was, you know, with the whole big sister thing, it was just like this one, I almost felt like it was something that carried on from my holding him since I was a kid. I think because Kelly was much older and it was harder for him to suddenly, and he thought he was the oldest of the group. And at first he thought we were adopted. He just couldn't, like, he didn't get the whole thing. It just took him, took him a while. But my brother Bob, who was in Haiti with me, had this gift. I think he was a great reader of comic books and science fiction things, and he just, like, he would play these games where he told my brothers here that we were from space, and that we had these special powers, and that, you know, if they were nice to us, like, we could all have the special powers together and we could be a stronger force. I mean, he was 10, you know, and when I look back on this, I'm like, how did he come up with this stuff? But it worked, you know. My brothers, they wanted some of the special powers, and it was a real tool.
Well, there was a moment where it could have gotten bloody, because I think, didn't he also say, we have these implants in our skulls, and that's how we can read your thoughts. And one of them was going to, I think it was Kelly, said, I think we'll cut that out of you tonight with this knife.
Yeah, he came, like, the next day he got a knife. He's like, doesn't it hurt? I'll help you. We'll have an operation. But I think now that he was really smart, he was like, I'll show you.
Well, the other very, very important person in this book, and ultimately who the book becomes about, is your Uncle Joseph, who comes off as such a heroic, wonderful person that we know by the end of the book he's 81 years old, and we've gone through his courtship with your Aunt Denise. We see him taking in these children so that at one point there's 5 of you in his house, and as you say, because these are kids that can't be taken care of by their own parents who are away cutting cane in the Dominican Republic or in Cuba or whatever they're doing, he doesn't say no to anything. He rescues one of his sort of adopted daughters from the Tonto Macoute after she's married off to this terrible guy, goes and gets her out of the house and brings her back. And you are there with him during some of his most difficult moments, where he's discovered to have throat cancer, has a radical laryngectomy, cannot speak a word, and this man is a Baptist preacher at that point. And you become his interpreter, the same way that you become the interpreter for the family. He sounds like a very remarkable person. Whether or not he was your uncle, he was one of these people that just seemed like a very good soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an incredible soul. And he was one of those people, I think, that he would not have considered himself heroic or different in any way. And I think there's so many people like this in Haiti who do their work quietly in their place where they live against incredible odds. And he was like that. I mean, it started off, he was the patriarch of our family, really. My grandfather, his father was called in Haiti a Kako, and a man who fought very hard against the U.S. occupation. And he was gone a lot in their childhood. And my uncle was really in charge, even though he was a child himself, was always in charge of his siblings. And he was the first person in the family to move from the countryside to the city, which we sort of, is our first family migration. And then all his siblings followed so they could go to school. And then he started he was interested in politics. He was a follower of a man named, a very populist leader named Daniel Fignolet. And when that didn't work out, he joined the church and started the church. And so he did these things to him, they were very matter of fact. And when he had cancer, he was diagnosed with throat cancer and lost his voice. And he came, that was actually his first trip to the United States. He came and had the surgery here. And then he went back to Haiti and just continued quietly his work until he was able to have a voice box. So it was just this incredible story. And we talked for a long time about writing a book about it. Like, he wanted to write a book about his experiences. He was also a very big chronicler of things. After he lost his voice, he was forced to, before he had the voice box, there were a few years in between, where he always wrote things down so people could know, you know, to communicate. And then he started writing things down during the coup, he wrote down sort of the casualties of the neighborhood. So he got this habit of scribbling things down. And even when, you know, towards the end of his life, we have a few of the things that he noted down on the airplane that we got in with his suitcase. So he was really, now, you know, you look back, I mean, I think sometimes you're around these people like this, you don't realize it, but I think he was in his own quiet way a visionary. He would not have considered himself exceptional, except he was exceptional to us, but he was just quietly doing what he considered, you know, his work in life.
Well, he certainly didn't deserve what happened to him at the end of the book. And we're going to take a short break right now and explore your Uncle Joseph a little bit more. You're listening to Edwige Dantica and her new book, Brother, I'm Dying. This is Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now, this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space perfect for browsing. And the Newberry Library's Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456 toll-free or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place, that is, Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, October 21st, when Victoria Lautman talks with Andrea Barrett about her book, The Air We Breathe. If you would like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book Brother, I'm Dying with its author, Edwige Dantica.
Thank you. You know, this is a good opportunity to just tell you to mark your calendars for October 21st when I will be talking to Andrea Barrett. She's the National Book Award winner of Ship Fever, The Voyage of the Narwhal, a bunch of others. And November 11th, Ann Packer will be here, The Dive from Clausen's Pier, with her new book, Songs Without Words. But more important, we have Edwige Dantica here talking about her family memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. And we're talking about the extraordinary character of Uncle Joseph, who really was your surrogate father, and even your own father, when the two of them were together and you were in their presence, which was not nearly enough, your dad would say to him, look at your child. What do you think of your child? He was that close to you. And it's interesting in the way that you go back and forth from the past and the present in this book that the politics, most of us are familiar to a certain extent with Haitian politics, but that is what dominates a lot of our view of Haiti is that, oh, you know, they have had terrible regimes there. It's very violent. The people are really poor. There's like these kind of capsules of things about Haiti. You keep the politics to sort of a minimal background noise in this book. It's just something to be gotten through. You don't focus a lot on, you know, how absolutely terrible the Duvaliers were. And there's violence that affects everything. But it's really when you focus on Joseph's story and what happens in, you know, the last week of his life that that we really, I think, feel the terror and the agony of what it was like living in Haiti, trying to keep your life together, trying to lead a good life, and having it just obliterated by the politics that you had nothing, there was no way to control it.
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, starting with the story that we're always told to about my grandfather, you know, with the U.S. occupation and through his life, I mean, through a whole thread in the history of our family, we'd always thought of the politics as they interweave, you know, with the history of the family. And I think everybody, you know, that's what people who live outside of a situation like that don't think about, is that people, it's not always a coup. It's not always an uprising. People, even, you know, even through an occupation, you know, people are falling in love, they get married, there's life too, you know, there's these things, but there's also life, there are families, and so I wanted to show sort of how these moments sort of hit, you know, struck my family in particular, as it did other families. My father, for example, he never, you know, when we talked about why he left Haiti, he always told us the story of working in the shoe store, where he worked in the shoe store and these Tonomakuts would come in and they would want the shoes. And so his boss came up with this idea of, we'll buy really cheap shoes, and when they come, just give them the cheap shoes, like the $3 shoes. And then it got scary because some of them didn't want the $3 shoes, and he was always worried about getting shot over that. Now, when people say, did you leave Haiti for political reasons? He would say no, because there were people dying in Fort Dimanche and in dungeons. So he didn't think that he was as affected as the politics of the other people. But in a way, you know, everybody had their own clash with the politics, with the history, if you will. So it's not, I'm not trying to keep it so much in the background, but I'm trying to show how these lives are interacting with the politics, not just in the politics in Haiti, but also the politics of the United States, starting with the occupation, ending with immigration policy in the United States at the same time.
Well, we're going to hear more about that in a moment, but I really want you to read from, you know, the last third of the book, last quarter of the book, when really we are immersed in Joseph's life. He's built this church. He's built a school. He's become an important part of the fabric of the community of Bel Air, where he's lived at that time for, I don't know, 50 years, I guess. And yet he is caught up in the violence around him through no real fault of his own. The church is stormed by people who are shooting at the gangs, and he's then blamed by the gangs. And this starts really the horrific nightmare that your family was plunged into, and the reason why this book is here. So if you wouldn't mind reading now.
Yeah, this is after, there was a period in the fall of 2004 where it was a series, it was the 10th anniversary of a coup d'etat against the President Aristide, who had been deposed twice, and Bel Air was really on fire, if you will. It was a time where the people were calling it like the Fallujah of Haiti. And so the provisional government had ordered these operations there. And the way that it seemed like they were trying to stabilize the country was to go in these very poor neighborhoods and just storm them and try to get at these gangs. And so after this had happened, these forces had climbed on top of my uncle's church and had shot at people. And so this is after he had managed, he talked to some of the people in the gangs, and they had let him go on the condition that they were going to come back. And so this is when the church gets looted. My uncle was completely surrounded, but no one was touching him. Everyone was heading further into the compound toward his apartment, the church. From where he was standing, totally frozen in a spot near a small outdoor grill that his daughter-in-law sometimes used to cook their meals, he could see many of his neighbors scurrying off with his things. Nana, an old woman limping with a cane, carrying some of his dinner plates. Danielle, a small girl whose mother sold water to him now and then, joining strangers as they walked with a handful of his grandchildren's clothes. He could now see the navy blue cotton and lycra suit he'd worn to his wife's funeral, the one in which he wanted to be buried, walking away on some boy's arms. As the crowd rushed back and forth around him, there went the charcoal grill and his wind-up alarm clock. He did not dare move to the other side of the courtyard, where a plume of smoke was rising outside the church. "They're burning the altar of the church," someone yelled, "and some of the direction, that is the school principal's office." The crowd began heading that way, but he remained in place, not moving. He wanted to go to the church, to see it, to defend it, to reclaim the altar. But what if the crowd decided at that moment to burn him too? What he couldn't see was the pews and the altar being dragged into the middle of the street and being set on fire. Part of his office, which was directly beneath the church, was also burned. His papers, including the dozens of notepads in which he'd jotted down words and sentences, his observations about the neighborhood in good times and bad, they were all scattered now all over the streets, being trampled, carried away, or burned. The courtyard was nearly empty now, with everyone's focus shifted to the church. The few people who were still milling around shamefully avoided his eyes as they walked by, one with a handful of toothbrushes that he'd kept on the night table in his bedroom upstairs. He had to get out now, finally leave the neighborhood for good. But how would he get through the barricades, where surely the gang members had people waiting, watching for him? As he moved towards the gate, he spotted Anne, the niece of his old friend Fernand, standing there across the alley watching him. Had she turned against him too, had her aunt? Anne held out her empty hands, showing that she was carrying nothing she had not stolen from him. "Vinny," she said, "come." He went without thinking, letting her drag him by the hand. Walking the slippery incline that separated his house from another small courtyard, he kept his face down, his chin as close as he could to his chest, without blocking his tracheotomy hole. He did not dare look back towards the church as a new wave of looters brushed past him heading there. He might have been tempted to follow them, to try to stop them, reason with them. He thought about all the wounded who might be lying somewhere dying. He thought of their mothers, fathers standing over them, unable to do anything but watch. The country was once again losing a generation of young people, some violent, some bystanders, but all in the line of fire, dying.
I'm going to take this moment to say, if anybody wants to ask questions, come down to the microphones if you do. We might have time for a few. What happens, we follow Uncle Joseph as he flees and escapes, and we are terrorized with him as he hides, as he goes, dresses as a woman, as he finally gets on a plane with his son Maxo and comes to the United States, and we all breathe a sigh of relief. Great, the man has survived. He's gotten out of Haiti. And I'm not giving away how this story ends. It's what the book is about. He is incarcerated at Chrome Detention Center. He is treated abysmally. His medicines are taken away from him. His family is not allowed to see him. They speak to him once on the phone in spite of a very high price and good lawyer's attempts to free him, and he dies in U.S. custody in shackles 4 days later. At that point, your book has become reportage. There's a moment where you switch over to the language of a reporter. There's a distance in your voice and a fury underlying it. It's amazing that you can keep yourself from, well, screaming. This could have become a rant. At this point, you go from being really an advocate, which you have always been for immigrants and specifically to Haitians, to an activist. And this book becomes an act of bearing witness in the way that you have done in others of your books, The Dewbreaker and The Farming of Bones. Without this event happening, you would not have written this book.
No, I wouldn't. You know, people sometimes say, well, you know, why a memoir? I mean, I think I call this book a memoir by default. I say to people that it's not a memoir, it's like a noumoir, it's an usmoir. and I wouldn't have written this book had this not happened. But once it did happen, it became so necessary because, again, for the reason I said that in this form, one of the reasons in this form is that, you know, it was one of the criteria, it seems like, you know, that they were, while the customs officer was making up his mind as to whether to release or detain my uncle, who, by the way, had a valid visa. I mean, that would have expired last year when he requested asylum. One of the things was, or is there media or congressional interest? And I think that, to me, you know, just gave me this job, and I felt like there should be media and congressional interest in everyone then, if that could have saved his life. And I switched to that tone in the book because we had to get through the Freedom of Information Act, the documents that enable me to write that part of the book, you know, the investigation report from the government. And I let their papers tell that story because I think it's easy to dismiss. Then it says she was angry, it's a rant. But I really wanted to use those documents to tell it, and I let people decide for themselves.
Okay, we have a question here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm interested in what writing means to writers, but I'll skip that. And I don't mean to be presumptuous. I don't know what your relationship was with your father exactly, your brothers, but you had commented on the question that your brother asked, and his response was painful. You said about whether or not he enjoyed his life, and I wondered if you thought there might be an alternate explanation. And it sounds like he wasn't surprised by it. Maybe those were thoughts he had had before, and maybe it wasn't a direct question that he was answering. It was just an opportunity for him to really say some things that were really meaningful to him, and how amazing is that, and how successful for him that you and the family could share on that level, and sort of what a powerful moment. I wonder if you thought that might be possible.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, because and that's what I meant when I said that I think it opened up a conversation, because those things were very hard for him to say. You know, for example, there was a bookstore in our neighborhood where near our house, and one time I went to read there, and the woman said, you know, your father's in here all the time buying your book. And I had no idea. And he wasn't the kind of father who would say, I'm proud of you. But you're absolutely right. That I think that was a moment for him to get to say these things. And from that moment on, we felt like we could ask him anything, you know, as he lay dying there.
Well, and you do point out in this book that the circle becomes complete at the end, that your uncle dies in a terrible way. Your father dies 6 months later, but not before he meets his granddaughter, Mira, too, named for him. And so there is this one, thank goodness, uplifting thing that comes out of all this. And she's 2 and a half. She's wonderful. And he got to see her before he held her. And you have pictures of that.
Yeah. I mean, he wanted so much to hold her. And I think that was also part of the conversation that we had, and that he would always say, I want, you know, like the meetings, you know, my dad was formal in that way, that he would say, I want to meet the firstborn of my firstborn. And he really, I think he held out for her. And even we spent, after she was born, they spent a month together. We spent a month with him. And we had to go back. And then 3 days later, he died. And so it was for him. And I think, you know, now that when you have a child, I mean, I have a child, you think that's probably the scariest thing for a parent facing death is that you worry about your children. But if they're older and they're okay, I think that must put a kind of, you know, a peace, you know, kind of levity to it, and you feel like you can go, even though we were never able. People would say, why don't you tell, you know, my father was really, at the end he was like 78 pounds and couldn't move, and people would say, just tell him to go, and it wasn't something we could say, and I said, tell him, you know. And so, but I think that was also, that goes both ways, you know, to tell us to tell him to go.
And you said you didn't want him to go.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's also a step one has to get to.
We'll take another question here. Thanks.
Welcome to Chicago, Edward Standica. Thank you. I think that you represent this Haitian restraint, or in your disciplining of emotion, you're doing the same thing in terms of your writing. And so as a part of your family, or this broader definition of family that you introduced to us, what can we do, or how do we become the activists that illustrate or that clarify some of that relationship between Haiti and the United States?
Well, I think you do it by being here and by your openness to it. Because I think people don't know. I think people, for example, with the things happening at Chrome, I think people just don't know that these things are happening. And so it's important, I think, to learn about these things, to know, it's very important to know what's being done in your name. I mean, it's become a cliche to say it now, but it's important to know that, to know those things.
Take another question.
First of all, I want to thank you for your books, and
thank you.
Just say how much I value the time I've spent in your company as I've read them. I'm a high school English teacher, and I have a number of my students here today. And if it's not inappropriate, I wondered if I could ask a question about the dew breaker.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
I wondered when you determined to tell the central story backwards, and also how you imagined yourself into the mind of the dew breaker.
The dew breaker is the last book that I published, and it's about a torturer, and it's told from the point of view of victims as well as his family members. It started with actually the story of the daughter, and I was writing a plain story about a daughter who is about to tell her father that she wants to be an artist, and then he just takes over the story and tells her something bigger, like that he has this secret past. And so that opened up all these other characters. And to put it in the mind, I think, you know, writing, I think, is like acting. I've never acted, but I've seen movies. And
weren't you in The Color Purple? Did you have a little? You did.
No, that was Beloved.
Beloved.
I had
Beloved.
A small part.
That's right.
But I think it's... you have to really step into the skin of the character, and whether that's male or female, and you have to think that's a human being, whether they're, you know, I think there's no such thing as pure evil or pure good, you know, there's complexity. So that's how I was able to put myself, you know, to actually inhabit the dew breaker before I could write about it. I had to make myself be able to feel for him like I would any other person.
I wanted to ask you about the fact that you have been sort of lumped in, isn't the word, but you have now been identified as the voice for Haitian immigrants. People often talk about you and teach your work along with the work of somebody like Juno Diaz or Alexander Heyman, these various people who have lent voices to specific parts of our culture that have been somewhat absorbed or brought in from other places. And how comfortable are you in that role? I mean, both as being identified as the voice of the Haitian diaspora and also as being part of what is now seen as almost a subgenre of fiction writing.
Well, I think all those people you mentioned, you know, and I know Sasha Herman and Juno Diaz, I think they would all agree. But, I mean, I won't speak for them, but I would say that I think when you... or from within a community, you know that there are a multiplicity of voices within the community. a lot of the time you know these people, you know that there's a breadth of talent, you know that there are all these people who speak in their different genres. So I would never presume to call myself a voice of that community. I mean, I think I'm one of many voices from the community. So I'm not. I don't think it's healthy for, you know, we're not monolithic. There are different, you know, there are many voices in the community, any community.
Let's see, we have another question here we have time for.
I wanted to ask about the second excerpt that you read, which was so exquisitely rendered. And I wondered if you were a witness to it or whether you were relying on other people's accounts and how you, basically the mechanics of it, how you were able to construct it so beautifully.
Well, that section of the book is reconstructed from stories like my uncle was with an aunt of mine who actually had to go and get him from the neighborhood. And so my aunt, I always say, could do War and Peace in 10 minutes. And so she was like, the whole time, she told me the stories. And of course, because I had been to all these places. And so if she says this person, I knew exactly who they were talking about. And they said I knew exactly what they were talking about. And also about this particular operation in which there were shootings from my uncle's roof. It was very widely reported in the Haitian press, in the American press, because they had modeled these types. This was the one of the first ones where these forces were just like storming these neighborhoods, and they made a lot of noise about it to scare off the gang members too, to like encourage them to flee the neighborhood. So there was a lot written about it. And in terms of sort of what my uncle was feeling, and so he had talked a lot to my cousin who was with him and my aunt who eventually really went and rescued him from the neighborhood.
I think that one of the most important things that I came away with from this book, and I'm curious about what you specifically want out of all the different components, you know, your own history, your father's history, your uncle's history, the history of Haitian-American relations, was the fact that you know, what happened to your uncle was something that was almost uniquely Haitian, that Chrome is a detention center and the way Haitian immigrants are treated is very different than the policy from other South and Latin Americans, Cubans, who, if they get here, they can stay, Hondurans, Nicaraguans. And I think that this activistic part of you now, which has spent time at Chrome even before your uncle was there and knew the horror of it, that this part of it is the part that I am going to, you know, really try and figure out more about.
Well, the thing is, what I always said to people too is that what's most exceptional about what happened to my uncle is how exceptional it is, and that you know, even with his circumstance being 81 years old and being frail, being sick, he was still sent to prison. I mean, that tells you a lot about the policy, and that even with his particularities, you know, an old man with throat cancer, and there was no exception done for him. And if he had been, I'm very convinced, if he had been anybody else, if he had not been Haitian, if he had not been black, he would have had a different treatment at 81 years old. So I think his treatment is very in line with this particular policy. And that policy, especially in Florida, has been for Haitian asylum seekers, has been defended in many ways. For example, when Ashcroft was there, he would say, oh, there are terrorists coming from Haiti in the boats, and things like that that were just spoken off, you know, just topped off to justify the policy. So his was in line with the policy that exists, particularly for Haitian asylum seekers.
Well, I want to thank you. I think that after reading this book, those of us who are already admirers of yours will look at your earlier work in a new way, and you've given us a great gift for your own life and for your family and for Haitians. And I really thank you. I hope we get to talk to you again. Edwige Dantica, Brother, I'm Dying. You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman, which will return on Sunday, October 21st, when Victoria's guest will be Andrea Barrett, author of The Air We Breathe. If you would like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Today's broadcast was made possible in part by Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456.